Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today marks 172 years since the Seneca Falls Convention, the very first women's rights convention in the U.S. It was held in upstate New York on July 19th and 20th, 1848. The meeting kicked off the women's suffrage movement. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, one of the meeting's organizers, began with a speech on the convention's goals and purpose. Quote, "We are assembled to protest against a form of government existing without the consent of the governed, to declare our right to be free as man is free, to be represented in the government which we are taxed to support, to have such disgraceful laws as give man the power to chastise and imprison his wife, to take the wages which she earns, the property which she inherits, and in case of separation, the children of her love." And while we remember Stanton's involvement in the women's rights movement, we should acknowledge that she primarily fought for the rights of white, middle-class, educated women like herself. Black men and women, and not so much. But since we're starting our look at voting today by reflecting on Seneca Falls and the early days of women's suffrage, we're including it in our Keep It 100 series, which recognizes women's role in maintaining democracy during this 100th anniversary year of the 19th Amendment.
Hey, you gotta keep it 100.
Joining now to discuss this is journalist Aaron Geiger-Smith, the author of a new book called Thank You for Voting, The Maddening, Enlightening, and Inspiring Truth About Voting in America. Kirkus described it as, quote, intelligent, spirited, and especially valuable to budding activists and first-time voters. Aaron Geiger-Smith, welcome to All of It.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Now, your second chapter in your book is about women's suffrage, so we're going to dive in right there. You write, when pondering a long-delayed victory, it's human nature to focus on the final achievement and not the thousands of actions along the way. We imagine women in formal floor-grazing skirts gathering for champagne toasts and clinking for joy that they received what is the most basic right of citizenship. And while we should look forward to raising a glass on the 100th anniversary, the celebrations should acknowledge how very difficult the battle for women's suffrage was, and the many complicated but heroic women nearly forgotten. Rarely do we pause to talk about the incarcerations, hunger strikes, and racism involved. So let's dig into all of that. Voting was different by state. In some way, in some states, women could vote before the 19th Amendment. So what changed by 1848, the year the convention was held?
What sort of instigated the beginning of this women's rights movement and suffrage movement?
Yes, please.
Women had been involved in the movement to stop slavery, and that kind of helped them get their own voices and want to fight for their own rights. And so when this convention came, they were looking into and pushing for all of those things that you mentioned. And suffrage wasn't really top of mind at that point, but it came up during the discussion. Some women were for it at the convention, some against it, but eventually it was included on their Declaration of Sentiments. And that's why it's kind of considered the kickoff of the suffrage movement, which lasted, as you just mentioned, a very long time. You know, it was 1848 all the way till 1920 before the amendment. And then, of course, we have to recognize that it wasn't until the 1965 voting rights that all women were actually able to use that right. So yes, it was the kickoff of a very long and exciting and complicated fight for the right to vote.
You mentioned in that paragraph incarcerations and hunger strikes. Can you fill us in?
Sure. So the British suffrage movement is sort of more recognized for that happening. But toward the end of the movement, when the suffragists were really pushing for President Wilson to take up their cause and support women's suffrage, there were regular protests at the White House. Those led to arrests and just terrible treatment of women when they were after they were under arrest and when they were in jail. And at that point, it was in July, also July in 1917, that hundreds of women telegrammed the White House saying, look, this has to stop. You have to give women the right to vote, you know, voting rights instead of jail time, essentially. And all of that was sort of the end of the big push. But, you know, we picture the parades, we call them suffrage parades, but of course they were protests. And so it was really all of that gathering and finally public sentiment sort of coming on their side that led to the passage of the suffrage amendment and the 1920 ratification. So it was, you know, the pictures are beautiful. And I just think mm-hmm. we have a tendency to think of it as this well-fought victory without giving a lot of thought to just how long it took and how innovative they had to be and how, you know, 1848 kicked it off with these meetings, but every generation of women kind of built on that. So from conventions to public speaking to figuring out how to use the laws in their favor, you know, saying, hey, wait, we don't need an amendment. We're already citizens. We have the right to vote, and pushing forward that argument. And then into the parades and using specific signage and just all of, they had to build on each other's work, and all of it, it took all of that work and all of that time to achieve women's right to vote. So it was really a group effort over 70 plus years.
My guest is Erin Geiger Smith. The name of her new book is Thank You for Voting. Well, let's talk about Seneca Falls.
Sure.
What was the original intention? What was the original goal of this convention?
You know, the goal is just to bring more recognition to women's rights and for all of the things that you mentioned, that they just did not have an equal position in society. So it was to talk to each other about that, and then to also, you know, hopefully make it a bigger issue that men would care a little bit more about as well. You know, I think Frederick Douglass's participation in the Seneca Falls Convention is a very important part of that story and of the voting story. So it was a big, you know, it was a 2-day long conversation. Men were asked to wait till the second day to speak, which I always think is a fun mm-hmm. fact. And it was just the start of trying to make women a more equal part of society.
Now, as the movement began to gain momentum, it grew, it changed. There were schisms, most notably those who prioritized securing women's right to vote and those who championed the same rights for African Americans.
Right.
What did this schism do to the women's suffrage movement, and who was arguing with whom?
Right. Well, so Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony really were upset at the time of the discussion of the 14th Amendment into the 15th Amendment that black male voting rights took the forefront of the discussion. And they just felt that women should be included in that discussion. Both of them had supported abolition. It's just they now made women's rights their main focus. And so they really took that and getting women's laws passed as their primary goal. And another part of the movement was just much more inclusive and was willing to work for black voting rights and women's suffrage at the same time. So, you know, that separation lasted for years, but eventually the groups did kind of come together and move back to their single goal of women's suffrage, a single goal actually incorrect, to the goal of women's suffrage, but also in part making it more of an inclusive movement. But even that has the caveat of oftentimes they were willing to kind of put to the side black women's right to vote so as not to upset southern states who wanted women to be able to vote, wanted white women to be able to vote, but not black women. So that you know, issue and schism and those and that racism lasted up until the passage of the amendment and beyond. So it wasn't something that was ever, you know, certainly not settled as we know very well mm-hmm. today. The issue of racism not settled then, not settled now.
My guest is Erin Geiger Smith. The name of her new book is Thank You for Voting. Let's talk about some of the other reporting in your book. Over the course of your reporting, you found that many Americans are not voting. So why aren't Americans voting, even though people, as you quote in a Pew study, says that it's essential to personal freedom? Why
right.
aren't Americans voting?
You know, there are a million answers, but I don't think a prominent one is laziness or apathy. You know, especially young people who vote at disproportionately lower rates. It's not that they don't care. It's that we don't do a great job of teaching people to vote and making it easy to vote. And I actually think a great example of that for people who are voters lifelong voters and vote all the time, likely felt a little confusion in the primary elections over mail-in voting. And being unsure about that is something how many people feel about voting at large. So I'm hopeful that we can do much better. We just need to make voting more convenient. We need to make it sort of this cultural idea of it's not just a thing you do, but understanding why you do it and how you do it. You know, often we stop the whole conversation with you should vote and don't talk about registering. And if in certain states you need an ID, just I feel like our lack of focus on the mechanics, in addition to all of the things we've seen in the news of continued voter suppression and the barriers that some people still face to vote. So it's a combination of all of those things. But I don't think we should blame those who don't vote. I think those of us who do vote should take on a much greater responsibility of helping those who don't vote to become voters.
You include a voting checklist on your book. Can you take us through what you think some of the key points are and things that we should pay attention to immediately?
Sure. I think number one, you should make sure that you're registered to vote. If you're not register. Many places help you do that now. And if you just Google register to vote, you can find what the rules are in your state. That's also really important, is understanding your state voting laws. Of course, you know, here in New York, we need to figure that out for us. So figure out if you're registered, and then check what's going to be on your ballot this time. Do you have a senator on the ballot? Is your mayor up? You know, all of those sorts of things. I think it's a good idea, even a few months out, to start knowing what's on your ballot and thinking about, you know, what you're going to want from those politicians. What I put on the checklist throughout is every time you do one of these things for yourself, you know, check if you're registered to vote. Talk to five friends about doing the same. Start a text chain where every time you do something on the checklist, you also get five friends. So it kind of stretches the power of your own vote if you get five friends or family members, your peers, to vote. Another thing that's on there that people may not think about is to ask your employer if they have a plan to encourage voting at your workplace. There are many ways to do it that remain nonpartisan, and it just basically includes getting people information. And I think that's another way people can make a big difference, is if their employer doesn't have a program, starting one to let people know about voting deadlines. And then what's so important right now is to check what your voting options are. With coronavirus, it has really changed that question. And so find out when your early voting period is and if that's going to be the best time for you to vote. Or find out what your mail-in procedures are. And if you can, request a mail-in ballot today. You know, that so many New Yorkers didn't receive the ballot they requested. I was one of them. I requested an absentee ballot and didn't receive it. So doing those sorts of things as early as possible is really important. And then I have, you know, get down to the nitty gritty on the checklist. Like the day before, check the weather. Are you going to need a heavy coat or an umbrella or, you know, sunglasses? Just make sure that you can make voting as easy as possible on yourself and really make a plan. Put it in your calendar today. When you plan to vote in November.
There's a lot of good advice in her new book called Thank You for Voting. Erin Geiger-Smith, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.